Very good friend, Dottie Shore.
I'm an alcoholic and my name is Dottie Shore. Hi. I can't tell you what a thrill it is for me to be here and to see those birthday cakes. When the guy took his medallion off and put it on that guy, he just broke me up. And the young man, how old is he? How old are you, young guy? Oh, my God. You know, I often think when I see people get medallions or cakes like that, I lost my teens, and I lost my 20s, and I lost some of my 30s. But God has restored all the lost years of my youth because of this program. We really don't know any age or any time in this. I came up yesterday afternoon to Portland and spoke for the Crippers last night. Had a wonderful time. Met a lot of people that I've seen before. I spoke for their convention and I've led a retreat for them. And then Norm brought me up here and Jackie up that beautiful gorge today up here. And to see my friend, I feel like I've known him forever, this wonderful David. We were supposed to be together, David and I. After we were at the convention and we talked and everything, and it was just David and Dottie, and I didn't know what his last name was, and all of a sudden he was gone. And I thought, my God, I didn't even get his address or his phone number. So I went over to the desk and I said to the girl over there, could you please give me the last name of a David that's from the Dells? And she said, no, we can't possibly do that. That's confidential. And I said, is there any way you can get any word to him? And she said, well, yes. So I wrote him a letter. And I told her he was from the Dalles. I didn't know what his last name was. And very unknown to me, he was not registered there. But somehow, because God wanted it, she found someone from the Dalles registered, and she mailed a letter to that person. And that person got the letter to David. Isn't that odd? That's God. That's God. And so David and I are supposed to be together, and I'm so thrilled that he asked me to give this medallion to him. And so we'll be lifelong friends. Tonight, I sat there and talked with John. And I only knew him about 15 minutes, and we were sharing things that you'd take about 20 years to know each other before you do it. The miracle and the magic of this program is just mind-blowing. Tomorrow, I'll speak at a showgirl meeting. Three talks in 2 days. Pretty good, huh? But it's wonderful. For years, people used to say, for God's sake, Dottie, shut up. Now they ask me to speak and pay my way. You've got to know everything changes. Everything changes in AA. Oh, Lordy. Anyhow, you know, the thing I like to share with you mostly is that when you've been around the program as long as I have, you hear the 12 steps read over and over and over and the traditions read over and over and over. And if you're not careful, you'll go someplace in your mind and be thinking of something else. Like I said, I'm not self-obsessed, but I'm usually thinking about me. And so one night, several years ago, I realized they had read the 12 steps and were almost through with it, and I hadn't heard one word. I'd been someplace in my mind. And it kind of scared me. I thought, hey, dummy, you know, that's what got you sober. You better start listening. And so I made a vow that night that I would close my eyes and listen to people read. And if you love the steps like I do, you put a different emphasis on each word. And I'd learn something. Well, the very first night I did that, I closed my eyes and I heard someone say, read. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop stinking. I thought that was very interesting. A couple nights later, someone said, animosity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. And then someone read, we'll now have Joe read the 12 positions of alcoholism. Now, please know I'm not making fun of anyone, because they keep out on reading. They don't even know they've said anything wrong, you know. So I started collecting them. And over the years, I've collected some beauties I thought you'd like, and I'll share with you. Another one was reading, and they said, many of his claims, what an odor. I can't go through with it. And then I heard someone read, humbly asked him to restore our shortcomings. There was a young man about 3 weeks sober, and he was visibly nervous. The perspiration was out on his head, and he was looking down, and he said, what, an order? I can't go through with that. And then I heard someone say, no human power can relieve alcoholism, but God could and would if caught. But the one I like the best is the last one. He said, our leaders are but twisted servants. They do not govern. I'm really selfish. You know, the reason I do this is because when you laugh and I laugh, I can get my breath, and I'm fine once I'm up here. I'm a wreck there waiting for somebody to call on me, but I'm all right once I get up here. I do have a cold, and I hope you'll forgive me if I start to cough. I'll try not to. Anyhow, you know, this is a wonderful thing we belong to. We are so fortunate if you have just an hour of sobriety and you're in this room tonight. You're the most blessed people in the world. Do you know how many people will never, ever, how many alcoholics will never, ever enter the doors of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? Do you know how many people will die without 2 days back-to-back of sobriety? And it wounds me when people say, I've only been sober 3 months. What do you mean, only 3 months? I had two sisters that died without 2 days back-to-back. After I was sober, they died. I couldn't help them. And it's strange how we can help everybody else who can't help our family. Everybody in this room has another drunk in them. But some of us don't have any sobering up time left. It reminds me when you go through the first door, to the door the first time to your AA meeting, God will hand you some invisible pieces of paper. And you have 1, 3, 10, I don't know how many you got. It's called sobering up time. And I punched my last ticket. I have no sobering up time. I got another drunk in me, but I have no sobering up time. Because I had to pursue alcoholism to the gates of insanity and death before I was able to finally, by God's intervention, be here tonight. I don't like drunkologues. You don't have to be taught how to be sick or vomit or go crazy, because you've all been there. And so I have to tell in a general way what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now, only because if I don't, then I start to take the program in my own hands, and I'm a real past master at doing that and doing it my way. But I have to follow what they tell us to do, and so I'm going to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now, and it's going to be very general. I drank about 19 years. I was alcoholic from drink one. At 14, I got drunk, I got sick, and I passed out. Now, knowing what I know about alcoholism, I was alcoholic from the very beginning. And I believe, had I been given alcohol as a child, I'd have been a baby alcoholic. Never had any real good drinking time. I was a sick drunk. I had to learn how to drink. And I loved what it did for me. I hated the taste. I hated the smell. You know, we have to kind of think about people saying, now, a young man who's 15 years sober, or 15 years old and sober, people would get up and say they would drink, had their first drink at 14. Somebody had their first drink at 8. Someone said the other day they had their first drink when they were 5. Well, finally, there's a man got up not too long ago in North Hollywood and said that he thought he had the record. That when he was born, the doctor cut the umbilical cord, took a piece of cotton and dipped it in alcohol, touched it to the stump, and he went into a blackout and doesn't remember anything for 5 years. We always top each other, don't we? But I love that. At any rate, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous on February the 8th, 1950. That was 37 years ago. I was only 8 years old, of course, when I got here. You understand? I always get those dirty laughs. So I don't understand why. I weighed 82 pounds. I was suffering from malnutrition. I had become a chronic alcoholic. The last 4.5 years of my drinking was around the clock. I was never drunk, and I was never sober. I had split lips at the corner. I was vitamin deficiency bumps. Taste buds on my tongue stuck up, so I couldn't eat anything hot or cold. I was unemployable. I couldn't drive a car. Couldn't arrange my hair by myself or buy a dress. I had 2 kids that I took fairly good care of. I kept my house clean, but I was a total basket case. I was unemployable. I had worked for many years in pharmacy, but I was no longer employable. But I didn't think I was an alcoholic. You see, for years ago back there, you had caricatures of what an alcoholic was. Now, an alcoholic woman was somebody in a bar with messed up lipstick and, you know, messed up hair, soliciting some guy to shack up for a drink, and her kids are home and they're hungry and the house is filthy. Isn't that an alcoholic woman? That's what I thought it was. And certainly if you're an alcoholic man, you're down in Main Street on Skid Row with wine bottles and wine sores and holes in your shoes and bottles around you. Isn't that an alcoholic man? So as long as I had this caricature in my mind of what an alcoholic was, I really thought I was going crazy. Really thought I was going crazy. I never thought alcohol was my problem. Now, I came to California with my family, my husband, and my two kids, about 1947 from Reno, Nevada, my hometown. And I have a sister that was 2 years older than I am. She's a radio singer, junior champion skier, and a model, and a baby sister 9 years younger. And when I got to California, my mother started writing to me about Evelyn. Now, Evelyn was the star of our family. My mother adored her. She dressed her like a princess. Everything was Evelyn, Evelyn, Evelyn. When we'd have company, my mother would sit down and play the piano, and Evelyn would sing. And I adored this girl. I thought she was the most wonderful thing I'd ever lived. But I was kind of lost in between the two of them. So when I got to California, my mother started writing about Evelyn, how much trouble she was having. I thought, well, thank God, she's off my case now. She's after her. And so over the Christmas holidays of 1949 and 1950, we went home to Reno for the Christmas holiday. And my God, when I saw my sister, I almost fainted. She had developed cirrhosis of the liver. Her stomach had swelled the size of a 9-month pregnancy. She was wearing dirty blue jeans and a maternity jacket and wandering the streets of Reno like a bum. Now, this was a radio singer, junior champion skier, and a model. And I was horrified. And God forgive me, that Christmas I called her a dirty alcoholic. I said, you've become a dirty alcoholic. Didn't know at that time that I was an alcoholic. And I said to my brother-in-law, for God's sake, can't you do something about her? Now, my brother-in-law said, Dottie, we've tried everything. We've hospitalized her. We've taken her to the psychiatrist. He said, if you don't think I've done everything, I even called a bunch of people here that call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous. But they can't help her because she doesn't want help. That's the sum total of anything I ever heard about AA. I came back to California just before the 1950 New Year's. And on the way home, my husband said to me, I hope the hell you never get to be like your sister. And I said, don't be silly. I got too much sense to let that happen to me. Listen to that. And so I thought, well, I'll go on my last drunk on New Year's. Nobody stops on New Year's, I didn't think. And then I'll put it away because I don't want to be like that. So on New Year's Day, New Year's Eve of 1949, before the 1950 New Year's Day, I went on what I thought would be my last drunk. I got terribly, terribly drunk, made a perfect ass of myself, had food on my lap and forgot it was there and got up and splashed it all over this woman's beautiful carpet and was just really a mess. And the morning of 1950, January 1st, I couldn't get out of bed. It was the only time I've ever been able not to make it out of bed. And I asked my husband to please bring me some booze to bed. And so, typically non-alcoholic, he went out and bought a bottle of old Ram's Head rye. I think they left the ram in it, I swear to God. And so I sipped on this junk until I could finally get out of bed. Now, I thought that was all I needed. And the month of January was the most hell I've ever gone through because I'd never had blackouts. I mean, hangovers. And I would get through to about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I would work so hard, and I'd clean the house, and I'd do a wash, and I'd do all the things I was to do. And then I think, surely a little drink won't hurt. And I never meant to get drunk. I thought to take a little drink, and I got drunk every time. Now, on June the 7th, 1950, I went into a blackout at 10 o'clock in the morning, and I came to 4 hours later in the grocery store with a grocery basket half filled with groceries. I was totally dressed. I had driven my car, and I didn't know what had happened, and I just screamed in the grocery store. The man told me later that he thought I'd had a fit, and I did. And I ran out of there and left my groceries and went next door to the liquor store, what else, bought the bottle and went home to find out what in God's name had happened. My wash was done. My house was clean. I didn't know what a blackout was till I got to you people. And so I was terrorized. And I opened the bottle and took a drink and went in and sat down to find out. I thought, I've really freaked out. I'm really crazy now. Because I never thought it was alcohol. And I had this drink and it kind of settled me. And I went out in the kitchen to have what I thought was going to be my second drink. And the bottle was almost empty. Another 2 hours had gone by. And I'm terrorized. And I was always afraid of my kids coming home and finding me drunk. So I ran down the hall, started to run down the hall, because the only clock we had was in the bedroom. And we had a hardwood floor hallway that didn't have carpeting on it. And as I stepped onto the floor, this foam started coming out of the hardwood floors. And I knew that it wasn't there, and I put my hand down and went like that, and it was swirling, reminding me something of dry ice and water. You've seen how it bubbles? I'm sure you've seen the astronauts when they went into weightlessness and they bumped all over the ceiling. I did that long before they did. Man, I'm not kidding you. I stepped on that floor, and I hit the ceiling and the side walls, and I remember screaming, "My God, help me!" And the next thing I knew is someone said, "North Hollywood AA Clubhouse." I don't remember if I dialed it or asked the operator. I have no idea. And the woman said to me, I said, how do you know if you're an alcoholic? And she said, is it for you or your husband? And I said, it's for my husband, of course. My God, yes. And she said, I'll be right out. And I said, you can't come out. I don't want my husband to know I'm an alcoholic. She said she thought she had an alcoholic and a ding-a-ling at the same time. So she said a very important thing. She said, I'll be out in the morning on one condition, that you're not drinking. If you're drinking, I'll leave. I want to talk to you and not the bottle. So that night when Al came home, I said, I got something important to tell you. Now, you understand I'm not dramatic. No alcoholics dramatic, are they? I put him in a chair with his back to me. And I said, now, don't look at me. And he sat there, and I said, I'm an alcoholic, and I called AA. And his shoulders started to go like that. And I said, oh, God, please don't laugh at me. He turned around and looked up at me with these tears coming out of his eyes. And he said, my God, I had the papers ready for you to be committed to Camarillo State Hospital. That close to being locked up. I'm sure if they'd locked me up, I'd have gone over the brink. Because I had such terror for years of being crazy. Well, the next night, I was supposed to go to a meeting. And my sponsor came over that next day, and she talked to me and told me I had a disease and the whole thing. I was to meet her at a meeting. And I went over to the North Hollywood Clubhouse. And I remember my picture of an alcoholic. My sister with her stomach swelled the size of 9 months pregnancy, dirty blue jeans on, her hair all messed up. Or somebody in a bar with messed up lipstick. And this is what I thought I was going to go see. That I knew, I was so frightened by this time, that I was going to go crazy, that I'd do anything. And I got to the back door of North Hollywood, and it's an old Episcopal church. And when I walked in to the door, I saw people just like you. I thought, oh my God, I got the wrong night or the wrong building or something. And I started to leave, and this woman called, and she said, can I help you? And I said, I don't think so. And she said, honey, are you an alcoholic? And I said, I think I am. And she said, oh, you're so welcome. And I started to cry. And it makes me cry at night. And she put her arms around me, and she rocked me. And she said, it's going to be all right, baby. It's going to be all right. And it's been all right. And that's what you are, you guys out there. You got different faces, but you're Alcoholics Anonymous. You're so understanding and so compassionate, so loving and so giving. And you saved my life. And I owe you so much. And you asked me to come up here to talk to you. Do you know what a thrill it is for me to be asked to talk? That I have something that's worth being listened to? That I'm not just a blob anymore taking up space? That if I died tonight, and I hope I don't, I've got a lot of the talking to do. That the world's a better place because I came across this world? That I held my hand out and helped one other person? If you've helped anybody in AA, dear ones, don't you know the world's a better place because you were born? Instead of, my God, you know, you come through this place and nobody misses you when you're gone. They're probably glad you're gone. Well, the first night I attended that meeting, everybody was so good to me. And I fell in love with you people that very first night. Now, the man that got up gave a 55-minute drunkalogue. He talked about fifths a day, sanitariums, jails, 502s, 86s. I don't know what the hell he's talking about, all those numbers. Told off 5 cars, lost his family, ended up in prison, had DTs and convulsions. And then he got to AA. And he sat down. Oh, I needed that like I needed a hole in my head. I thought, my God, I scared myself into this thing. I didn't drink that much. I didn't drink that long. I didn't do those things. Maybe I'm only a little alcoholic. You can't be a little pregnant, you know. But I didn't tell anybody. I was scared to death if I said to the lady who was to be my sponsor, I don't think I'm an alcoholic, that you'd say, fine, then leave, and we don't need you. And so I broke 2 important rules. If any new people here, please hear me if you hear nothing else I say. 2 important rules you must not break. Number one, your life must become an open book to one other human being. Not human beings. You know, we're compulsive confessors. We get up here and shoot our mouth off and think, oh my God, I wish I could get my mouth shut. One other human being your life's an open book to. And number two, secrets will kill you. You're sick of your secrets. My life did not become an open book. I kept all these secrets. But back in 1950, it was like a men's stag group. You got to remember that. Very few women, mostly men. The women were tired of hearing the men. So they found out I had this gift of gab. You didn't know I had that, did you? Not much. And they put me on the circuit when I was 49 days dry. I went from Bakersfield to San Diego and from Riverside to Santa Barbara, any place in between. 365 meetings and more that first year. My weight came back on. I became employable. My family quieted down. Everybody thought I was wonderful. They started telling me how great I was, and I began to agree with them. And I thought, my God, I wonder how you guys get along before I got here. I'm a great teacher. I have a photographic memory. At one time, I had total recall. I could pick up this page and read it, put it down, and give it you back to you, common period. Booth took care of that. But I have a tremendous photographic memory, so I memorized pages of the book. My sponsor was a bookwoman, and she would just quote the book, and everybody was so impressed with her. So I'd watch her face and their faces, and when she'd quote, I'd run home and memorize that page, and then I'd start to quote it. I quoted it, I read it, I recited it, I memorized it, I did everything with it, but practice it. I can tell you, somebody said today, and I've never heard it, maybe it's common to this area up here, I had a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. Doesn't work. Now, I didn't drink during this time. I didn't have any trouble staying away from alcohol. I thought an obsession, my sponsor said, you haven't had an obsession to drink, have you? And I said, no. I thought it was to keep me out of the liquor store and my hand off a glass. I had no problem. Didn't even crave a drink. Now, the reason I didn't crave a drink was because you had given me what I needed, what my deeper-seated problem was. My deeper-seated problem, one of the biggest ones, and see, alcoholism is only a symptom, remember, of a deeper-seated problem, and my deeper-seated problem was an erotic need for attention. I was a pathological liar, an exaggerator, a buffoon, mispronounce words, stumble, fall down, do anything to get you to look at me. Now, if I could have stayed with you a long time as you continue to pat me on the back and tell me how wonderful I was. I get up to speak and you'd all applaud. And I was getting fed what I needed. Had I ever taken an inventory, I would have found out that that's what I needed, was this neurotic need fed. But I didn't take inventory. I didn't have to. That's for you ding-a-lings, you sick ones. I took your inventory, but didn't take mine. And so the year went by on the wings. Now, the first night I attended the meeting was a birthday cake celebration. And we were on a stage, something like this, and I sat there in the front row and saw these people up there on the stage with corsages on, getting presents, and everybody clapping for them, and my little mind said, God, all I have to do is not drink for a year, and I'll be up on the stage, and you'll be down there looking at me, and I'll have my night on the stage. I had sat in an audience for years and watched my sister get roses for singing, and cups for skiing, and modeling, and all of a sudden, I've got a chance, for God's sake, to get on the stage. So I think now, looking back, I must have just gone dry, because I sure wasn't sober. See, I was just away from alcohol, and being away from alcohol is not being sober. Well, the year went by on the wings, and I've got babies stacked up like cordwood. I've got more babies at North Hollywood than anybody. I went to a meeting every night. I became employable 3 months after I got sober. I held down a 40-hour-a-week job, took care of 2 kids and a husband and an apartment. Now, by God, you got to know that's something. And the adrenaline was just shooting through me. I was walking 5 feet off the ground, never tired, just kept going all the time. And the year went by on the wings. February the 8th, I got off the podium in North Hollywood and got my cake. Now, these people that got their medallions, my God, I rehearsed my acceptance speech for 6 months. You should have heard it. It was wonderful. I knew it forwards and backwards. You know, very eloquent. And I got more presents than I got an antenatal birthday. I looked down, my family sitting in the front row, and I guess I thought I graduated that night. I had made it. Now I'm an old-timer. Got a year. You understand, don't you? And the adrenaline starts to leave, and I'm getting tired. Well, after all, I'm an old-timer now. I'll just sit back and let the newcomers take over. That year after I had my cake, terrible things set, and I didn't even know they were happening. I went to a meeting in Azusa. Do you know there's such a place as Azusa down my way? And it was a driving rainstorm, and the windshield wiper hardly took the rain off. And when I got down there, I was exhausted from driving. And when I got there, it was a place about this big, and there was a table set up like this, and there were 6 old people sitting in there. And I thought, gee, they arrived late at this meeting. Well, the meeting began, and there were still 6 old people there, and I thought, how dare they ask the great Dottie Shore to drive in the rain to speak to 6 old people? So I gave some half-assed pitch as I went on, and I got mad and left. Now, when you call me to make a talk, I'd find out how big your group was. It was a big group, I went. Small group, I sent one of my babies. You got to realize who you're talking to. Are you impressed? I was so damn impressed with me, I almost died. Tell you what happened. I got drunk on ego. E-G-O. Edging God out. If you take credit for 1 minute of your sobriety, you're in for trouble. No human power can relieve alcoholism, but God can and will have sought. Now, if that are not true, then so help me God, I would go around and give you all a little bit of my sobriety that are new in here tonight. I can't do it. I can share with you my experience, strength, and hope. I can 12-step you. I can talk to you. I can love you. But I can't give you sobriety. You can't buy it. You can't sell it. And you can't steal it. It comes directly from the hand of God. And I didn't know that. Well, a lot of things happened. I started turning down 12-step calls. God, forgive me. One thing I can say in my defense, I'd never let them go. But I'm an old-timer now. I'm not going to call on that new drunk. But my babies call on them. You know what an old-timer is, by the way? Somebody who will fly 3,000 miles to make a talk and won't go across the street to help a newcomer. Got any old-timers in here? I want them to call me a long-timer. The hell with that old-timer. Leave that old stuff out of here. Anyhow, the foundation was poor. My foundation was on shifting sand. I remind myself of the man in the Bible. The two men. One man was a very foolish man. He built his house on a wise man built his house on a rock. And a storm came and slashed at that house, but the house was built on a hard foundation, and the house stood. But then there was a foolish man who built his house on sand. And when the storm came, the house fell, and great was the fall of that house, because the foundation was on shifting sands. And my foundation was so bad that the first thing that came across my path that I couldn't handle, oh, I had 12 steps, I knew all about them. Head knowledge alone is not enough. And the first thing that came across my path, there was something that I didn't like or stress, and I had to go down. Great was the fall of the house of Dottie Shore. I went to a meeting on June the 10th, and it was a beginner's meeting. And the leader said, how many newcomers are in the room? And about 15 people raised their hand. You know what he had the nerve to say? You are the most important people in the room, he said. I'm like, hell, they are. You lose that newcomer, you haven't lost anything. You lose an old-timer like me now, you've lost a great deal. You understand that, don't you? Can you hear this? I must never forget that this Dottie Shore lies just below the surface. And if I don't do the things I did today, she's got a good chance of drinking and dying again. And I didn't even know that. I thought I was doing great. I can tell you all about this program. I can tell you exactly how to work it. Now, how could it happen anything would happen to me? Well, I broke my meeting pattern. I'm tired. I'm disgusted. And it's raining out. Who the hell wants to go to a meeting in the rain? Never stopped me from drinking in the rain. But don't go to a meeting. It's raining out. Isn't that right? Besides, it's too cold. Or it's too hot. Or there's a good television program on. Or I've got a headache. I don't like the leader. I don't go. Dear one, supposing we've been diagnosed as having AIDS, God forbid. And the doctor said, I'll tell you, we can't cure this thing. But we can arrest it if you'll go to a couple, three meetings a week, sit on some hard chairs, drink some lousy coffee, and lie to each other a little bit. We can stay sober. We can cure this AIDS. There wouldn't be meeting places. Would they say it's too hot? It's too cold? There's too much rain? If they thought for 1 minute this thing would break out. But see, we are more deadly than AIDS. They're working like crazy. Thank God they're working. And they'll come up with a cure for that thing. But there is no cure for alcoholism. We cannot be cured. We can have our disease arrested. And we can stay sober according to our spiritual status. But remember, we have no defense against the first drink. We have no mental defense against the first drink. We will never win in single-handed combat against alcohol. So if you think you can stay away from meetings and make it, you can for a while, but you'll eventually go down the tubes. I broke all the rules. I went home from the meeting that night after I was so resentful of that speaker, or the leader. And on the way home, I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll get drunk and I'll punish him. Did you ever get drunk at your mate? I used to get drunk at poor Al all the time. Now I'm going to get drunk at the whole North Hollywood group. I'm going to punish him. They're going to be sorry when this old timer's gone. I went in total fantasy. I thought, I know what'll happen. I'm going to get sick. Not very sick, so I'm not going to drink very much. I'm not going to drive my car. You taught me a lot about drinking, as I was a home full of windowshade down drunk. But I could see Al coming home and finding me drunk. He goes to the phone, he calls North Hollywood, and he's saying something like this. My God, Dottie's drunk. And they're saying, oh, no. And they get in a caravan of cars and come over and 12-step me. When they get there, they ask me to forgive them, and I forgive them. And we kiss and make up, and they take me back to North Hollywood, and I'm a newcomer again. Isn't that a beautiful fantasy? You know it didn't happen, don't you? And I get up on June the 11th, 1951, and I cleaned my house. Didn't want to call any, have them call any slob. And I put on my earrings and my makeup and put on clean underwear. Like I always said, something always happened when I drank. Mother said, have clean underwear on in case you're in an accident. So I did. And I walked to the liquor store and I bought the same half pint. Now, if there's any Al-Anon people here, I got to tell you something, you alcoholics. If you decide to drink again and you hide a bottle and you can't find it, just ask an Al-Anon to come in. They're like a ferret. They'll find it. I would hide the bottle. Al would find it. He'd hold me at arm's length, pour the whiskey down the sink, and I would die. Because I had long since taken 3 and 4 drinks down, vomited them all up before one stayed down. But he'd hold me at arm's length, pour the whiskey down the sink. I'd have to get up the next morning, get those kids off to school, get him out of there, collect the nickels, dimes, and pennies, and walk to the liquor store and get my booze. Now, that is terrible. That's torture for an alcoholic. So I had to find a place to hide my bottle. And as luck would have it for me, I found that vinegar and bourbon are the same color. I was looking for a place to hide it, and I looked on the cupboard, and there was the vinegar bottle. So I took the vinegar bottle out of the cupboard and poured it down the sink, poured my whiskey in the vinegar bottle, and put it right up in the front of the cupboard. Now, Alcom told him finds me a little drunk, right? He moves that vinegar bottle back and forth all over the cupboard. Never did find my supply. But it's different now. See, I don't care. I'm a circus speaker. I'm 16 months without a drink. I'm going to put that bottle out on the coffee table. I'm not going to hide it. Put my feet up there and tell Al to go to hell if he doesn't like it. I went and bought the same half pint, came home, took the vinegar out of the cupboard, poured it down the sink, poured my whiskey in the vinegar bottle, took my first drink out of the vinegar bottle. That's how much I've changed. And when that whiskey burned my throat, and please hear me, it was like someone slapped me. Like that, and I came out of this like a dream, like a sleepwalk. And that was the first realization I had that I drank. When that whiskey burned my throat, I was mentally drunk long before I took the drink. And see, when you reach for the drink, you've already gotten drunk up here. I tried to identify with a drinking pattern, and today I can't identify with a drinking pattern. My capacity was very small. You probably spilled more than I drank. But please identify with the thinking pattern. It's the stinking thinking that leads to our drinking. It's a real old cliche that we had in the program a long time ago. But I had stinking thinking, and it was up here that I got drunk. When I reached for the drink, it had been long ago all over. And I stood there terrorized, waiting for something to happen. And see, my God, I loved you so much. It was the one thing in my life that I cherished more than anybody, more than life itself. And I'd thrown it away. And I stood there terrorized, waiting for something to happen. And I waited, and nothing happened. And I thought, hell, I knew all along I wasn't like those drunks over at North Hollywood. So I walked out in the kitchen to get what I thought was going to be my second drink. And what I tell you now was told to me by my husband. I remember nothing from the time I said, my God, what have I done? There goes 16 months of sobriety shot to hell, and waited, and then thinking, I knew I wasn't a drunk like those people, and started to walk out in the kitchen. And the window shade came down. I remember nothing from that time on. And Al was an outside salesman, and we'd had an awful fight that night. He decided to come home. He was really worried. There was no Al-Anon in those days, and he said, my personality had twisted back to, I might as well be drunk as the way I am. Those sons of bitches don't appreciate me. I'm talking like I did before I got to AA. And I had totally changed during the 16 months. So he came home that morning, thank God. And he heard me screaming a half a block before he got to the house. Now, when he opened the door, I was on the front room floor, screaming and beating my heels on the floor till I almost shattered the bones in my heels. I had dry heaves, so I broke a blood vessel into my esophagus, and I'm vomiting blood. I retched, so I broke the blood vessels in my eyes, my eyeballs, hemorrhaged. And I went totally limp when he tried to get me up off the floor and put me on a couch. Now remember, no care unit, no detoxes, no hospitalization, no doctor who touches the 10-foot pole back there. But because he was terrorized, he remembered that 2 blocks from where he lived was a medical center. And so he just ran. He didn't even take the car. He just tore out and went up there. And there were 7 doors along a sidewalk, and he came to the first one available, and he went in, and the office was full of people. He went up to the receptionist, and she was busy, so he went past her into the doctor's examining room. Now, you've got to know he was terrorized to do that. Here's a guy laying on the table with a sheet on him, and Al goes busting in there. I kind of laugh about it now, but I don't think it was funny then. And he grabbed the doctor and said, "My wife's been sober 16 months. She's drinking, and she's dying. For God's sake, come with me." And dear ones, the first of many miracles was to set forth for Dottie Shore, because he didn't say, "Get the rescue squad," or "My God, another drunk," or "Who recommended you? Fill out this form." You know, they do that. He didn't say a word. He just picked up his black medical bag and left the office and ran the 2 blocks to my home with my husband. And do you know why? He was an alcoholic. Isn't that odd? That's God. People say, "What a coincidence." It's a complicated way of spelling God. When he got there, I was still on the floor. He put the stethoscope on my chest, and he turned to my husband. He said, "Mr. Shore, we're too late. There's no heartbeat, no pulse, no respiration." So on June the 11th, 1951, Dottie Shore died of a killer, terminal, filthy, rotten, stinking, cunning, baffling, powerful disease called alcoholism. And the only reason I'm here with you tonight is by the grace of God. Now, the grace of God means a free, unearned, unmerited, unwarranted gift. And if you have sobriety tonight, it's only an hour. On your shoulder is the grace of God. You can go like that and brush it off if you want to. Or you can put it on you like a warm blanket on a cold night and snuggle into it. Because no human power can relieve alcoholism. But God can and will if he is sought. And if you are sober tonight, you are sober by the grace of God. A free, unearned, unmerited, unwarranted gift. Please remember that. And I'm not trying to sell you anything. I'm telling you rock bottom truth. Now, when Al got hysterical, the doctor told me later he didn't think it would do any good. He took a needle about that long out of his bag. I guess it must have had adrenaline in it. And he shot me directly in the chest cavity, gave me artificial resuscitation, and truly by the grace of God, my heart started beating. Now, let me take you back. Supposing Al had been a minute late coming home. Supposing the doctor waited 2 minutes. They could have brought my heart back, but my brain would have been damaged beyond repair because you can't be without oxygen that long. You know how much I had to drink that morning? 3 straight shots of whiskey. Is it how much you drink? Is it how long you drink? Is it what brand? Is it how old you are? Whether you eat or don't eat? See, all those things I thought constituted alcoholism. And I can take you now and say, can you guarantee what's going to happen when you take the next drink? Well, you may think so. I thought the door to AA swings both ways. I'll get drunk, I'll go back to AA, and everything will be hunky-dunky, right? And dear ones, you know how many funerals I've gone to since I've been sober? You know, I've gone to 2 funerals of 2 babies who went to sleep with a cigarette and burned themselves alive. And we had little piles of ashes the next morning. Beautiful girls. Lovely girls. I stood at the court and saw the most beautiful 31-year-old ex-Ice Follies girl sentenced to Patton State Hospital because she took the drink that wiped away her head. I kid you not. The last girl I lost, and I hope it's the last one, 2 years ago Christmas, had 4 years of sobriety, had 4 little kids, stopped going to meetings, got mixed up in a relationship. Oh, God, you know what I'm talking about. And she got drunk. She got up on a chair in the kitchen to change a light bulb that went out, and she lost her balance and fell against the stove. But she was too drunk to know she was hurt. She ruptured her spleen, and she bled to death before we could get her to the hospital. You can't beat it. You can't beat it. Do you hear me? You can't beat it. It'll either drive you insane or it will kill you, and it's a slow, slow death. My sister Evelyn, beautiful, talented, radio singer, champion skier, and a model, died 3 years after I was sober. The last words she ever said on this physical plane when she came out of an operation where they removed 5 ribs trying to tie off all these broken blood vessels. She's bleeding from every opening in her body, and she looks up at my brother-in-law as she comes out of the anesthetic and said, "My God, get me a drink," and dies. You think it's a pretty death? No. The medical profession tells me that a non-alcoholic who takes 1 ounce of alcohol kills 10,000 brain cells. Now, granted, we have billions, but the alcohol goes into the non-alcoholic's brain and out within a matter of hours. It goes into our bloodstream, to our spinal fluid, into our brain, and stays there for about a year. Listen to me. You see people get up here and get a one-year cake, right? And they'll say, oh, God, it was wonderful. The monkey's off my back. Beautiful year. Everything's wonderful, and they have a good time. They get up to get their second year, and they'll say, God, that was a bitch of a year. You know why? Let me tell you. Let me tell you why. It takes between a year to 18 months for the alcohol to leave the brain. And if you mixed a little drugs in there, it's going to take a good 2 years. And by that time, your nerves start to go like this. And there's no mind-changing chemical. There's no sedation. And if you don't have an awful lot of this program and a lot of meetings under your belt, you're going to go right down the tubes. Now you watch how many people we lose between 1 and 2 years. Then you watch how many people we lose between 5 and 6 years. By the time you're 5 years old, you know everything. You don't have to go to those damn meetings, sit on those hard chairs. Besides, they didn't elect you chairman. So you're mad, you're not going to go. Somebody said in the meeting this morning that Norma and I attended that she was so scared because she heard of a 20-year-old person, 20 years sobriety, going down the drain. And she just put chills all through her till she found out the 20-year-old stopped going to meetings quite a long time ago. We can't do this. If you had cancer and the doctor told you you must take your medicine, would you say, oh, well, I've got 5 years of taking my medicine, I don't have to take it now? We forget that we're our own doctors. The medical profession can't help us. The ministry can't help us. Our families can't help us. The only people that can help you are sitting in this room tonight. And you will never, ever get well. You can arrest this disease and stay that way according to your spiritual status. All right, I went back to AA. Couldn't understand why the hell I had gotten drunk after I'd worked so hard. I'd done everything I thought right, and I had to find out. Well, I thought I had a two-fold disease, an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. Now, the obsession said to me, you're not like these people. Maybe you're only a little alcoholic. Maybe if you get your thinking straightened around, you can drink again. Not now, but maybe one day. Now, the book says it better. The great obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow, some way, someday, we're going to control and enjoy our drinking. The delusion is astonishing. Many will pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. I had blackouts and hallucinations. Dear ones, that's the first sign of brain damage. I lost my total recall memory. Thank God that's all. And then I pursued it to the gates of death because I was pronounced dead. How far do you have to do it? Now, when I got back, I became willing as only the dying can to do what I had to do. And I am convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that I have another drunk in me. But I know that I know that I know I don't have any more sobering up time. And for now, because you've loved me so long and you've helped me so and you cherish me, if I got through physically, I think it'll blow my head right off to think I would lose you people. Where would I go if I lose you? To my family? Oh, I love them. But they don't understand me. Go to my church? I haven't gone back to a church of my choice. They don't understand me. They say alcoholism is a sin. It's not a disease. It's a cop-out. So where am I going to go if I don't have you? I'd as soon die. I'd as soon take a gun and blow my head right off than to ever go 5 minutes without you people. I love you from the bottom of my heart. The only thing in my life that's ever made any sense to me. The only people when I have something like breaking a teacup, not say to me, my God, you little thing like that upset you, do you?
You say, and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine and turn the tape for the rest of the message. Thank you. At this time, please stop your machine.
Maybe you didn't, but at least you give me the understanding. Oh, I wouldn't give this thing up for anything. I could have been born, lived, and died a hopeless neurotic, running through people's lives like a tornado if alcohol had never come in. Now, I don't think God made me an alcoholic. No way. God does not do that. I think in his infinite wisdom, he stepped aside and allowed this thing to come into me and drove me to my knees and to you people to make me a better person than I would have been had I not been an alcoholic. Out of my weakness has come my strength. I'm a better person because I'm a sober member of AA than if it never happened to me. So I'm not just a blob taking up space. I'm adding to the stream of life only because I try to carry a message. So are you guys. You sitting there listening to me is the greatest 12-step job you can ever do. Telling me you love me. Like my buddy over here. I wasn't with him 2 hours, and I feel like I've known him forever. You don't find that out there. No way do you ever find that out there. So I love it. I love everything about it. Well, I found out my missing link. Twofold disease? No, darlings. Threefold disease. An allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind, and a spiritual illness or a soul sickness. Now, those aren't my words. That's a book. And see, I had put God away 19 years ago. 19 years ago, I had to put him away. Now, I was born and raised an Irish Roman Catholic. You can't hardly get worse than that. Understand that, don't you? They said if you take all the Irish Catholics out of AA, we could meet in a phone booth. Sure. Anyhow, this poor alcoholic priest who died drunk because there was no AA in his day absolutely scared me to death. He told me every time I committed a sin, I was nailing another nail in Jesus' hand. That when I committed sins, that I made the Virgin Mary statue cry. Oh, terrible things he told me. Then when I was getting out of this bad situation of the talented Evelyn and the baby sister, I ran away and got married when I was 16 to a boy 17 who didn't have a job. I'm really smart, you know, I didn't get away very far that time. I went home to live with my mother, and I was pregnant 2 months after I was married, and he didn't want the baby, wanted me to have an abortion, and I was horrified. So I decided to go ahead and have that baby. And I guess I was happy that 9 months better than I'd ever been. But she no more was born until I was praying she'd grow up and get out of my hair. I was scared to death of her. And this young man wouldn't hold her. He said she was more like a sister than a child. And the marriage went down. Now, I didn't have to go home to my mother. I was already there. I just kicked him out. But we lived right across the street from the Roman Catholic Church. My grandfather homesteaded in Reno and built the Catholic Church and all the schools. And we had nuns and priests in our house many times, although Mother and Dad were not devout Catholics. And so I was out wheeling the baby one day, and this priest was walking up and down reading his office, and he came over and asked me when I was going to have the baby baptized. And I said, not till I get married again. Do you know you don't tell a Catholic priest that? Just thought I'd tell you. Don't do it. No. They don't like it. Don't tell them that. And he said, you can't get married again. If you do, you'll be living in adultery. Any child of that issue will be illegitimate. And I pulled myself up in my self-will, and I said, I don't care. I'm going to get married again. And he said, you're excommunicated. Well, loved ones, if God had called and said, Dottie, this is God, you're excommunicated, couldn't have been more valid to me. Because the priest was God. And so I walked away from the church. I walked away from God. I walked away from Jesus. I threw everything out. And for 19 years, I wandered the face of this earth like a lost soul. Now, Al and I got married. He adopted my first baby and raised her. And Sandy was born. And Sandy was sick for the first 7 years of her life. She's a very healthy adult today, thank God. But she had high allergies. And back in our day, there was no antihistamines and no antibiotics. And so they told me I would never raise her to grow up, because she would die in infancy. Every time she got sick, God was going to kill her and punish me for living in adultery. And that's how I lived. So when I got back now to AA, and they tell me I must turn my life and my will over to God, I can't do it. I simply cannot turn my life over to that crackpot up there on a cloud that's going to pull that lever and put me straight to hell and kill my kid. How can you turn your life over to that? So my sponsor said, everybody says you got to find a new God. Well, God's not lost, so where are you going to find him? Anyhow, I went searching, and I was had to say thee and thou and hold my hands in a certain way and my head in a certain way and kneel. And so when I went to the people in AA and asked them, how do you believe in God, they said things like, you mean the old man upstairs? And I, oh, my God, that's blasphemy. Somebody else said, old HP. I thought, oh, my God, I hope he's not listening to all this going on. Terrorized me. And there was a man standing over in the corner, and he said, Dottie, get over here. He said, if you want to find God, will you do as I tell you to do? And I said, yes, I will. He said, I want you to pray for 1 week. No other prayer but this one. You say, God, reveal yourself to me as you really are. And then start looking. Oh, loved ones, what a prayer. I prayed it 100 times a day. literally 100 times a day. And in 1 week's time, he got off that cloud, threw away those books and that long white beard, and became my daddy God. Wish I had time to tell you about him. It's the greatest thing I've ever had happen to me. He loves me so much that he has greater things in store for me than I can think or pray for. If I would stand here and tell you an outlandish thing that I wanted, he has better things than that for me. Because my ideas got me drunk. My finest ideas got me drunk. And so what I learned is to realize that he did love me, that he's not punishing and rewarding, he's not good and bad, he's all good. That he loves you, and he loves me, and we are brothers and sisters. Because every night we close the meeting with our Father. It doesn't say your Father or my Father, we say our Father. And in a week's time he told me he wasn't a Catholic. That was the nicest thing he ever did, was tell me that. And God's not a Baptist, did you know that? And he's not a Methodist. God is not religious. God is pure spirit. Religion is a man-made way of worshiping God, and you get mankind in there, and they're going to terrorize you. They're going to get you so scared you're afraid not to put some money in the basket, and you're being too afraid not to go to church, and you're going to be too afraid to do anything. Many of the things I had to learn that were taught to me by the Roman Catholic Church are not true. They told me there was a place called purgatory, and there's no place in the Bible that says that. They taught me I had mortal sins that could never be erased, and there's no place in the Bible that says that. And little by little by little, I dropped all the religion. And as I grew spiritually, and as my sobriety started coming, my head started to clear around, I then decided, after a few years, to go back to a church of my choice. And I thank God I was able to accept Jesus back in my life as my Savior. And I'm not trying to proselyte Jesus to you. This is God as I understand him. I read the Bible and I've gone back to church. And I've come full cycle. And I'm at peace. And I can ask God for anything. You know, my mother was pure Irish. Can you imagine her turning over in her grave and I got on an airplane on on Friday the 13th and flew up here? She never could have stood it. I had 1,000 superstitions. Everything was bad luck. I had so much unthinking to do. You people who didn't have a religious background, you are so lucky. Yeah, I didn't have so many old ideas I had to throw out. They say we tried to hold on to our old ideas, the results are nil. To let go absolutely. And I had to throw out an old idea and put in a new idea, and throw out an old idea and put in a new idea. But it doesn't say throw away your old bad ideas or your old good ideas. It said we must be willing to let go of all our old ideas. The good ones will come back. Don't worry about it. In the meantime, you'll lose a lot of garbage, and you'll have peace. Now, the one statement I love more than anything is when Jesus said, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world give it, but my peace, the peace that passes your understanding. And see, my life has not been out there in sobriety what I'd like to have it be. Oh, it's been absolutely magnificent. But a lot of things I would rather not have. And yet I still have that peace that passes understanding because it comes from God. Now, my two sisters both died of alcoholism. My mother and dad have died. My oldest daughter is an addict alcoholic who smashed her life away. My two grandsons are both addict alcoholic. See, it's hereditary. It goes through the family. My oldest grandson has 14 years of sobriety, and my youngest grandson has 120 days as of today. You know, God, listen to that. I went through a divorce 33 years after my marriage of a non-alcoholic husband who was very emotionally ill. Took him every place I could to get well, and he to every counselor, and he chose to stay sick, so I had to walk away. I've had a lot of things happen I didn't want to have happen. But in spite of all of it, I have that thing in here that I call the peace that passes understanding. Now, I believe, and you don't have to agree with me, we have a hole right here. And it's got a big mouth in it like that. And it's insatiable. You'll never have enough of anything to fill it. There's not enough sex. There's not enough marriage or divorce or money or property or prestige or beauty or houses or clothes or cars. You can put it in there, and for a little while you think, now I'm going to be happy. And 2 days later you're hungry again. And you know why? It's a God hole. Only God can fill up that hole. So you say, Lord, come into my life. Make my decision to turn my life and will over to your care. You come into my life, and the mouth closes. And you can take a big breath, and it goes all the way down, and comes all the way out, and all of a sudden you feel complete. and you haven't got that hole in your gut with the wind blowing through it, because you're filled up with the only thing that'll fill that hole, and that's a God hole. So you cannot be separated from God. He's nearer than you're breathing. Take a big breath. He's closer than your hands and feet. So run, alcoholic, run as far as you can run, as fast as you can run. You can't run fast enough or far enough to run away from your God. You know why? Because He loves us with an infinite love. Just as much as I love my kids. I'd give my life for my children. I have 3 grandchildren that have never seen me drunk. I have 2 great-grandsons. You want to make a hit with me, tell me I don't look old enough to be a great-grandmother, okay? But I mean, these are miracles. These are miracles. I could have missed the whole thing. 35 years ago, had I died, I wouldn't have seen those 3 grandkids, or my 2 great-grandsons, or you. Many of you were not even born when I got drunk. Aren't you glad I came around and stayed so you'd have a program when you got here? I think it was very nice of me. I think it was very nice of me. Now, let me tell you. I found out in inventory that my neurotic need for attention almost killed me, right? So I admit to God and to myself and another human being, not human beings, the exact nature of my wrong. My wrong at that time was pathological lying. I couldn't tell you how many lies I told. I couldn't tell you who I told them to. But I had to find out why I felt the need to lie. Now, if you're a thief, why do you feel the need to steal? If you lie, why do you lie? If you're lazy, why are you lazy? If you're a criticizer, why do you feel the need to criticize? Don't you know we have to get down underneath? So in my lying, I found out that the underlying thing for my lying and exaggerating was a neurotic need for attention. Now, if I'm going to continue on lying, I'm going to get drunk. If I get drunk, I'm going to die. And I don't want to die. But what do you do when you reach the sixth step where you have to become entirely ready to have God remove the lying? And that means no more attention. Nobody's going to be impressed with me anymore. See, when I see a near accident, by the time I tell you, my God, I'm out there turning a tentacle on the man's arm and saving his life. My name's in the paper. Dottie Shore saves a man's life. Well, I'd make you believe it. Now, if I don't lie or exaggerate, who's ever going to notice me? But if I lie and exaggerate, I'm going to get drunk. So I'm between the old rock and a hard place. And I thought, well, I don't want to die drunk. I don't want to meet God drunk. I thought if I get drunk, I'll meet God drunk. I didn't want to do that. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to become entirely ready. Now, this is the step. Become entirely ready to have God remove my pathological lying, meaning no more attention, just a big blob again, but that's all right. So I became entirely ready to have God remove my lying and exaggeration. I went to the next step and I humbly asked Him, humbly means respectfully, reverently, asked Him to please take this lying and exaggeration away. Well, something happened. The lies would still build, and they do today. But they don't come out. I knew He had done for me, finally, what I couldn't do for myself. But a magical, mysteriously wonderful thing happened. He didn't take the lying away and leave a hole in me. If God removed my defects and left a hole, I'd look like a piece of Swiss cheese up here tonight. I had a guy say he couldn't ask God to remove his shortcomings, he'd disappear. And I think that's true. But God took away the pathological lying and the exaggeration, and He refilled it with a virtue. And that's why I'm here tonight. So you fill my neurotic need for attention, loved ones. You tell me, oh, I can't tell you how much you helped me. I heard your tape, and God, it saved my life. Some woman, lady last night said, I take you to work with me every morning in my car. I'm getting all the attention that I ever crave so badly, and I don't have to tell one lousy lie, and I don't have to exaggerate one bit. God will not be outdone in His generosity. You give Him a stinking defect, He'll give you a virtue every time. How about that? Didn't you get a pretty good deal? I think we never had it so good. Now I'm going to tell you about the last thing I've learned. I hope I keep on learning, but about 2 years ago, I was at a step study meeting, and I guess you must know how many times I've known these steps. My God, I can quote them frontwards and backwards. But I heard them read that night, and I heard these words, having had, past tense, having had a spiritual awakening. What the hell's a spiritual awakening? Is that not going to liquor store? Is it having some kind of a one fuzzy good feeling inside? What's a spiritual awakening? Well, in the back of appendix, book of Appendix 2, it says a spiritual awakening. Oh, listen. A spiritual awakening is a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery. Holy moly, I never knew that was there. And I've been at this thing now 35 and a half years. 35 and a half years sober, and I never knew that was there. I thought the 12 steps says was to carry a message and practice these principles in all your affairs. And the first part of the 12 steps says, having had a spiritual awakening or personality change as the result of these steps. Not because I went back to church, although I do. Not because I accept Jesus, although I have. Not because I read the Bible, because I do. Suppose not hit that door at North Hollywood and they just said to me, I'll tell you what, honey, you accept Jesus and you'll get sober. I would have died right on the spot from fear. But you were smart, sneaky. You got me in here. You helped me find a new God. Then you helped me relax enough to have God reveal himself to me as he really was. And so I have had a spiritual awakening or personality change sufficient to bring about my recovery. Physically, spiritually, and emotionally. Physically, I weighed 82 pounds. I'm very well. The only trouble I have is I lost the digestive enzymes in my stomach. And I had chronic diarrhea for 5 years until they finally found out, an endocrinologist found out, that I had no digestive enzymes, that alcohol had killed it. So I take a digestive enzyme after my meals. I'm fine. I'm very lucky, very lucky. And so physically, I'm fine. Mentally, I couldn't hold on a job. I couldn't drive a car on the freeway. I worked in pharmacy for 23 years. After my husband and I separated and divorced, I went back to UCLA. I worked 40 hours a week and went to school for three and a half years at night. Came out of there 17 years ago with my certificate, and I've been in private practice since that time. Who, me? Moi? I have something to help somebody when I couldn't even pick up a spoon. Ah, and spiritually, from a God of hellfire and damnation who was going to kill me and burn my kids, to a loving daddy God. And I've had it, dear ones, as the result of these steps. Oh, please work them. Please give yourself a break and practice these principles in all your affairs, and things will change for you. They'll change for you so that you'll say, thank God I'm an alcoholic. Thank God my neuroses broke out into a disease called alcoholism, and I was driven to my knees beyond my will to come here and find a little bit of heaven. You know, just recently we celebrated Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday. And I saw him on television not too long ago. They were running some excerpt from him. And he said the words that I think we ought to take into AA and embrace it to our heart. He said, free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last. And loved ones, we're free. Thank you. I love you very much.